This is CliffCentral.com.
This morning we've got lots to talk about. And I think according to Nando's, today should be at least a little lemon and herb, but at most extra, extra hot. Let's start off. Canton, hey, morning. How are you?
Hey, guys.
Very good.
Missed you last week.
Yes. Pumi, you good?
What? Canton says extra hot. I'm not sure.
No,
hey?
I said extra hot.
Are you the extra hot?
Yeah, no, he's always extra hot. The two of you, please.
I prefer spicy myself.
All right, let's get into a few of these. There are a couple of stories. Now, I chose a few, and these are probably kind of ridiculous, but we will answer before the end of today's burning platform. Who has a better Twitter, Helen Ziller or Donald Trump?
Ooh.
What are you looking forward to when Boris Johnson becomes the PM in Britain? Who needs a father figure and therapy more, Phumzile Van Dam or Andile Mritama? And you're hired to help the DA and the EFF. What is your advice for both parties? Those are your questions. And go. No, I'm kidding. We'll start off.
I think that Phumzile would be a great father figure for Andile.
I think, I actually, when I saw this yesterday, Gareth, I thought, I don't know if it's the father figure that's problematic. I think Andile kind of needs his mother to call him to order.
Mm.
You know, he just needs his mother to give him that look that says, hey, wena. Because he's...
Yeah, not enough claps when he was a child, maybe.
Derailing. I'm that guy.
All right, but we'll save that stuff for later, because the State of the Nation address was this time last week. Well, it was in the evening, so we didn't get to talk about it. Any thoughts on the President's State of the Nation address? He urged South Africans to not give up on the dream of a better society, to return to the objectives of the National Development Plan, land and economic reform at the top of the agenda. He said, let us imagine a South Africa we so long to have. And then he went on to give some kind of blueprint for achieving this vision, born out of the Freedom Charter, liberation movements, injustice that they need to overcome, dire challenges. He went on to some granular stuff around Eskom and the state-owned enterprises. But what do we think? Go ahead, Pumi. Canton?
It's clear that he went out and saw Black Panther and got inspired. And
Wakanda.
I think it's good that the president actually goes to the movies. You know, we learned when we were kids that Disney's stories are not real. But, you know, it'll take a while for that part to actually set in.
Yes, and neither are Marvel Comics stories real. But that's okay. He saw Wakanda.
He did.
You know, we had... kind of forecasting, and I told you guys that I don't know. For me, when I listen to that State of the Nation, is I look for the places where I think there would be opportunity. I was so bitterly disappointed because there was nothing, no matter how hard. So I listened, and then I downloaded the speech and read it again.
Nothing.
He starts out by saying he's going to he had seven areas.
This
I think
comes
that
from
he was
someone who watches the State Capture Commission in her spare time.
Gareth, I read the speech. Then went back to read to think maybe I didn't hear something. Mm. I went back to read it, and he starts out by saying, you know, there's seven things he's going to concentrate on, and then he gets lost and waffly. And I actually, the thing that I thought about afterwards is I wished that what I wanted to hear from him. So when he did his first one, and he was also inspiring with his Tuma Mina, right? If ever he had looked for inspiration anyway, it's in a Zulu nursery rhyme that goes, and I will never sing it because I don't sing in public.
What type of Zulu are you?
Go on. How does it go?
Masidonse ganyeganye. You know, it's a nursery rhyme that we learned at creche, and what it actually means is, let's pull together. You know, so it's a
a cooperation.
Yeah,
thing.
let's pull together. If we work together, we're gonna move forward a little bit more. Canton, you may remember this. Lee Kasumba had that Harambe, which right. I think that's where we need to be as a nation. You know, we need to be at a place where it's tough. It's going to be tough for a while going forward, but we kind of need to stop dreaming and start doing. We need to start working. We need to pull together towards a particular singular direction. Right now, everybody's just doing their own damn thing. And I wish that he'd been advised on that.
He can't even get his party to do the same thing, let alone the whole
pull
country.
Pull in the same direction, NJ. You know, together. In the same direction, together.
All right, so... if Cyril's dream for South Africa is Wakanda, then what is the dream for Ace and Didi Mabuza, who's the second in command, and that coterie? What's their dream? Because we've spoken about Cyril's dream. We've heard him. He articulated it. It sounds infantile, but he's got a dream. What is Ace's dream? What is Didi's dream? What is Supra Mahumapelo's dream?
I suppose it is the Wakanda dream, which is to claim the throne.
Okay. But they don't have any other desires. It's purely the aggrandizement of self and the accumulation of personal power.
Well, if you look at them, can you imagine what they could possibly want in life other than that?
But I think people are complex. I'm trying here to understand what it might be that drives someone like Ace Magashule, because he can't be he's not a moron. He rose to the top of the ANC despite all our misgivings about him. There must be something that motivates him in the morning, that gets him, you know, ready to fight with the president. I mean, you need a tremendous amount of energy to be able to tackle the things that he's tackling with as little support or as much support as he may have on a daily basis. What motivates people like Ace? I need to understand this. I'm, as a psychologist even, I'd love someone to sit down and just try to figure out what's going on in his head.
Well, perhaps a starting point would be what motivates the president.
Hmm. Do we know?
Because, you know, I take a look at the guy and he seems distinctly unmotivated. You know, he delivers in this, well, dare I say it, lackadaisical fashion.
He smiles, he makes an effort, he's not a bad orator.
He's a terrible orator.
He's a terrible orator.
Well, I mean, maybe if you come from a base of Jacob Zuma, who at least had some charm.
Yes, well, no, Jacob Zuma's a fantastic orator. When Jacob Zuma is speaking off the cuff, I've said this often.
Not from a script, though.
Yeah, not from a script. Jacob Zuma from script is terrible.
Yeah.
But Jacob Zuma just off the cuff, mm-hmm. and especially when he breaks into his stories, you know, his anecdotes of his childhood and all of that kind of stuff, he's mesmerizing.
Oh, my goodness. Did you see the video that's been trending of him talking about the Mabena incident? Mm-hmm. Just watching that, I was just like, this guy is having the time of his life. We're all in disarray here. Everyone's like running around like headless chickens because everybody has sold us this. This is the reason why everything is so not great. Everything is cut because this guy's having the time of his life, watching the Mabenas telling the stories of where he's been and what he's been up to. And then this week, you know, that little note saying he's coming to the State Commission. I'm just like, are we going to have a week in July where nobody is doing anything because we're all glued to that Zondo Commission to see what the man has to say?
I will be. I think we all need to know. We've been desperate for an explanation. Let's see what his explanation is. All right, I want to go quickly to some... There was a lot of reaction from the different parties to the State of the Nation address. Just, any commentary
just,
on those?
Well, there's just one thing that I want to say in terms of what the president was going on about. It's clear that these guys don't have a clue that the whole idea that you can take kids and teach them how to code when they haven't learned the basics of mathematics is just so utterly outrageous. Coding is not something that you can teach anyone.
But who is going to be doing that teaching? Are we having is there a whole like SATU on board? Like all of that.
But the idea that you can start learning how to code when you don't understand logic, and logic flows from having a basic understanding of mathematics. The idea that you can actually miraculously start teaching kids how to code, it doesn't work. You can teach people mathematics, but it starts with teaching them mathematics, and we haven't gotten to that point. And when they keep talking about the fourth industrial revolution, they're completely clueless. I doubt they can name revolutions 1 through 3, for that matter.
No, exactly. Yeah.
And all of the other bits that came in between that, you know, count as part of that continuum.
No, I when I look at the speeches of just about everybody in Parliament, there are only a few who I suggest would have read more than one long book. Really.
Yes.
It's an unfortunate thing. It's because these people are perhaps just as... that maybe they are very one-dimensional. And that's to go back to my question about Ace, for example. Maybe he is just someone who is hungry for power, and that is his sole motivation. Maybe that's all he wants in the world.
Well, these guys have been brought up in the ANC. They've never... known a career. They've never, you know, built something with their hands.
Hmm.
They don't know how to change a light bulb in most cases.
Yeah. All right, let's talk to somebody who's who's been talking quite a lot lately. Mabine Siabe is from the DA and has some interesting points of view on the Sona reply, which we'll get to in a moment. But this is especially after he tweeted, "I bumped into a cabinet minister last night who was imbibing some vino. The minister is now struggling to stay awake while his line manager speaks at the podium." So let's hear what Mabine has to say. Hey, Mabine, how are you?
I'm very well, and yourself, Kath, and good morning to the listeners.
Good. Why are you causing trouble by reporting on drunken and tired ministers?
I'm not causing trouble. Ministers, as well as the MPs in general, are paid a handsome sum by the people of South Africa to advance their needs. We've stated to the president on many occasions that I will work with him when he puts the interests of the part of the people of South Africa first rather than his party. But when his party members go to parliament to sleep rather than work, this is a problem, and I think it's something that the president needs to address, and we'll speak to the leader of government business to ensure that his cabinet ministers come to parliament awake and ready to do the people's work.
All right, so that sounded like a statement that I was expecting to hear from you, but the part that I'm interested in is where this happened. You don't have to tell us which minister necessarily, because it could be any of them, as far as I'm concerned, but where did this happen, and how did things proceed? Did the minister carry on snoozing?
I think because he was seen on television, one of his colleagues tapped him, and he made an effort to stay awake.
Do we know who this is, Pumi?
Gungubele.
Was it?
Gungubele.
Was it Mondli Gungubele?
It was not him, but I'll not state who it was.
Okay. All right. So tell us about your response to the State of the Nation address. I heard Musi, and I heard Julius, and I heard Groenewald from the Freedom Front Plus. I didn't hear any of the others. Musi, more or less, and I haven't heard his reply in Parliament, but I heard his comments straight afterwards. He more or less criticized the president for being a dreamer who doesn't realize he's actually living in a nightmare. Is that more or less the DA's position after some more inspection of the president's words and the actual documents?
I mean, in the last few days, we've seen reports of Denal employees not being paid, SABC's lights soon going to be switched off, and yesterday the Auditor General painted a very grim picture of the state of South Africa's municipalities, some of them not being able to actually pay the employees. And then on the other hand of this, the president now wants to build smart cities but unable to manage the cities that we already have. So we just need to go back to basics before we want to do pie-in-the-sky dreams. If we're able to implement the policies that we already have, political parties are able to work together to ensure that we can get economies working, then, in fact, we can start building smart cities and so on. But we don't have the basics ready yet. Let's go back to basics to ensure that we're able to get the people of South Africa working, that infrastructure is there to ensure that companies invest in municipalities and ensure that service delivery happens. If we can get those very basics right, so then we can start talking about what it trends and so on. But until we get there, the president's speech will remain a dream rather than a reality for the majority of South Africans.
All right. Anything you want to ask, Canton?
I'll say what? No, sorry, I fell asleep.
Sorry, Canton's not a fan.
Yeah, it's a very early morning. Look, it's what we expected that we were going to hear, but I mean, thank you for coming on board. It was nice to see a little bit of lightheartedness coming out of the DA social media circles when you tweeted that about the minister, because what we often see in the DA social media circles, it's a bit of a circus.
Yeah, what's going on there? I mean, you guys, you allow all your MPs to tweet whatever they want, right?
Except for Helen.
Well, I mean, we're, as a democratic party, I mean, people must always have their views, but there are views out there that members of parliament and other public representatives tweet that do not align with the party's vision and values, and we take the necessary steps to ensure that that does not happen. There are structures within the party that people must go through in order to ensure that their voices are heard, and if they disagree with people, then there are platforms in which they are there to use. Fighting on social media is not helpful for anyone, because, like, as I've stated, the people of South Africa want us to work for them. They don't want us squabbling amongst ourselves.
All right. Thank you very much, Mabine. Nice to speak to you.
Sure. Likewise. Cheers.
All right. Cool. Well, there we go. There's a comment from the DA's communications boss. You know what? He's the executive director, this is a proper title, of communications for the Democratic Alliance. Let's get on to some other stuff. I did hear the replies.
But that used to be Gwen.
It was Gwen. No, Gwen's gone.
Gwen's gone.
Gwen's back in the happy world of not being involved in politics. Like Canton, who's back here with the Burning Platform, which we're pleased about. All right. If you had to give advice to the DA and the EFF, I want you to really apply your mind for a second. That's why I sent you these questions last night. If you honestly were in charge of communication strategy for these two parties, and you could argue that the EFF have done better than the DA since Jacob Zuma, because they've at least managed to shift the narrative into their court. It's become about land. It's become about all of this stuff. The EFF also won more votes at the election than the DA did in terms of their total overall growth.
True.
So you can argue that some are already doing it better than others. But if you had to advise them, Pums, where would you start? DA.
Oh.
What would you tell the DA to do? No, come on. You have to help them now. You're being paid a lot of money. Let's imagine you are their consultant.
I think for both the DA and the EFF, the one thing that we see a lot of is a lack of clarity on what it is that they stand for and ensuring that all of the people that are out there for stand for the same thing. They speak on the same, you know, they speak from the same song sheet. But I've always said to you that I think the EFF's sole purpose is to pull the ANC to the left. They keep coming up there and talking about what the ANC is not doing. I was very interested to see Julius talking about in the SONA responses, talking about the ANC's resolutions and Cyril's lack of commitment to the ANC's resolutions. I'm thinking, why are you talking about the ANC's resolutions? This is not your party. You've got an opportunity to talk about your party and your policies and what it is that you want and communicate that. Don't worry about these guys and what they're not doing in their party. Think about where you are and what you want and communicate that to us. And, you know, there's a lot of...
But this almost speaks to that conspiracy theory that the EFF is really just a vehicle for the ANC to be moving more left.
Polarized towards the left.
Correct. And that maybe there's the long game that Julius will eventually come back home.
He will.
Okay, and then that being the case, if you believe that too, then all of this is really a sideshow.
Absolutely. But I think that the EFF have done an incredible job in that communication space. Mm. They've done an incredible job of holding everybody's attention and pulling us all into where they are. I mean, they've done it with the ANC. You know, they've made ANC.
And let's give credit too. They did it on social media, and they've done it in the real world as well. They have their rallies, they have their speeches. They always get plenty more media coverage than anyone else because they're entertaining and interesting to listen to, even if they're talking nonsense.
Look at Julius's commitment to becoming the kind of person that people listen to more and more. People are, you know, he lost weight, he got married, he's changed his whole thing. So he's gone from being that crazy, unmanageable young person to being something that, you know, people can look at and kind of go, oh, this guy could be a statesman.
Yeah, even with people who don't necessarily like him or agree with anything he says, they very often are forced to admit that the guy makes some sense.
I think when even just directly after SONA, when he came out of Parliament and they asked him outside, just the Vox Pops, asking him about his first kind of thoughts, he was so, for me, so concise in that he was like, what is Cyril has been dreaming about becoming the president for 25 years. He's been wanting to be the president of this country. And here he is. He is now the president and he's got no plan. He wanted this thing so badly and now here he is and he's got no plan. And I just thought,
it's a very valid point.
It's a great point. It's a concise point and it's a tweetable
All right,
point.
But you've missed, you've left out the DA. So what would you advise them? What would you tell them to do to get more votes and to fix themselves before the next election?
Well, they need to start off by telling us what they stand for. And, you know, that goalpost has been shifted so widely that until you get to that stage where they actually define what they want, other than that they want to get the black vote, which you know, clearly they do.
They must close shop.
They must close shop. I think
they must close shop. Yeah. I think they've. I think the.
What do you mean by that? Split into various factions that put themselves up in separate forms for election. Are you talking about just dissolve the party? No, they're not going to dissolve the party. They've got the second biggest constituency in parliament.
Yeah, they, you know.
That's ridiculous.
They should close the party, and people should go to the parties that represent what it is that they stand for. Because the DA is kind of, at the moment, the DA is so schizophrenic in who it is and what it stands for and who it wants and what it can sell in any of those people. It can't be everything to everybody. So that's
ANC tries to be that, their whole broad church positioning.
Except the ANC is quite clear in the fact that it's as they say, you know, they stand for a non-racialism. Mm. So they're quite clear in saying, these are the 10 things that we stand for.
Well, and they stand for non-racialism with quotas.
With quotas. Mm.
Mm-hmm. If these 10 things appeal to you, come to us. The DA, on the other hand, is on diametrical sides. No, you know, you have...
Betwixt in between.
You have a Helen who believes that colonialism was the best thing ever to happen for us, and then you have a Pumzile on the other hand. You know, those two things, how do those two people...
Why are you misquoting Helen? She never said colonialism was the best thing ever to happen to us. Jeez, Pumi, don't do that. This is how fake news spreads.
Gog Helen, man. Gog Helen.
All right, well, whose Twitter is more interesting to you, Helen or Trump? Because they're both, in some ways, they don't follow the rules. And this is something that keeps
Trump
coming
up. Trump
tweets
from a position of power, which is a very different thing to Helen's position. I think Helen's obviously far more articulate and certainly far more intelligent, I think. But, but Trump tweets from a position of absolute power. He is heading up the world's only superpower. And obviously... what that lends in terms of gravitas to every little thing that he says. Remember that Trump just has to say something slightly out of whack and markets the world around.
Reverberate.
Immediately, yes. So it isn't really a question of who's more skillful. Trump certainly knows how to play his audience brilliantly.
But here's my point, right? The reason I'm trying to tie these together and I went from one into the other is because I bumped into someone from the DA the other day and they said to me, well, what do you think we should be doing? And that's why I asked you guys too. And I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not a political analyst. But I said to them, I think that their secret weapon, and you're probably going to shout me down for this, but their secret weapon is Herman Mashaba, because he doesn't really give a shit either. He's a bit like Trump in that sense.
He is completely fashioned himself after Trump.
Right. So maybe he's copying. Sure. But I think that there's something about him, you know, self-made man, and now he's gone into politics, and he certainly seems to be winning the EFF over in the city of Joburg, which is interesting. He speaks out very openly and sometimes puts his foot in his mouth, just like Trump. But I think he's kind of a secret weapon for them. And he's definitely, there's one thing that's absolutely right about Herman, is he's very authentic. That is how he is in person. I've met him a couple of times. That's how he is in his public role. And he's not a bullshitter. Like, Trump's not a bullshitter either. These two are, like, solidly authentic, whether you love them or you hate them. And there's good reasons to love or hate them on both Trump and Mashaba's scorecard. There's something about politics, the politics we've moved into now, that makes all those pandering politicians look really weak. Don't you think that if you had a Tony Blair now, he'd be laughed out of the room. Yeah. He was so fake. And to the same degree, I've got to say, if Barack Obama was running now, he wouldn't stand a chance. Because he was like a really consummate, polished politician, but not terribly authentic in terms of like having that grit. He never put a foot out of place. He looked too perfect. It's one of the reasons I admired him as a politician.
But draw this distinction between Trump and Mashaba. Mashaba never puts people down. So you'll notice that, you know. So Trump
Maybe illegal immigrants.
No, that's not putting people down. When I'm saying singling out individuals and just basically being mean and nasty with them.
Good point.
Yeah. Mashaba never does that type of stuff. Look, I actually stand with Mashaba's point in terms of illegal immigrants, because a country that doesn't actually ensure that people are coming in legally, well, can we even call ourselves a country?
Well, if you are going to, then you must accept that your sovereignty is worthless as well.
Exactly.
So then you must be told what to do by other countries.
The difference in terms of the way in which Mashaba operates versus the way in which the rest of the DA operates, Mashaba is not there in the sense of being a career politician.
Right.
I think he is really determined. I mean, Joburg is his city, and I think he really is determined to leave the city a better place than at the point at which he actually took over. Now, I disagree with a lot of the stuff that he's doing. I think that he should be fixing traffic lights and potholes and so forth. But you have to admit the way in which he's going about the inner city rejuvenation and trying to build a sense of community in a space that frankly, it is a shithole. And I think that all of the building blocks that he's putting in place, he's very focused on that stuff. And so the very pragmatic alliance that he's put in place with the EFF around allowing him to run the city in that way actually plays into that. Mm. And it's a very different model from what happened in Nelson Mandela Bay, for example, where there was that very definite antagonistic approach in terms of the EFF. Mm. And with the result that...
But which remains. Yes. That antagonistic relationship with Nelson Mandela Bay and the councillors.
Exactly.
Now they've got that complete lunatic, but if you're suggesting
that Herman Mashaba represents the mainstream Democratic Alliance, I disagree. I think that he's an aberration. I think he's actually good for the city compared to anyone else they could have put in place.
I don't... More than that, he's an aberration. The one thing that Herman Mashaba shows us is that if we had an opportunity in the municipal level, in the city level, of individuals running without a party backing, because I think that's what happened to Herman. Mm-hmm. Herman thought, I want to run the city and I have ideas of how I'm going to run the city and change the city. And the only way I would ever get there is if I tag myself onto this party. I don't believe it's because he believes in the DA or its policies or politics.
No.
Or
that anyone does.
Prior to this. And which is why I'm saying the DA, the best thing that can happen for the DA, never mind the fact that they do have so many people that are their members, is to actually just dissolve and allow people to align themselves to parties that are more in line with what they all believe in.
But those parties don't exist for DA voters.
Exactly.
Well, they don't exist.
Yes. Quite
for DA voters or for DA members?
DA voters. Who cares what happens to the members? No, I'm saying that those parties don't exist. Like there isn't a party that can... There isn't one party in this country that is straightforward and upfront about the free market, for example. There's no one who's speaking honestly about that, privatization and that kind of thing. They all mouth, platitudes, and they try to be as general as possible.
Well, the DA doesn't believe in privatization.
That's my point.
Yes, they still have this idea of the big state. Can we talk Osaka?
Yes, of course. What do you want to talk about Osaka?
Well, you know, there's this kind of meeting that's happening in Osaka this
yes,
weekend.
Yes, tell us.
Yeah, the G20 summit.
Oh no, I didn't know that it was happening this week. I'm not like you are. You're with the Bilderberg. You're in the Bilderberg family. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, basically
the G20 this week.
This weekend. If you follow Tito's tweets, you would know that he's now off to Osaka, and
or you'd be buying pilchards.
Yes, which are made in China these days, by the way. I think sudden outrage. People have discovered that Lucky Star now comes from China.
What frightens me is that you said made in China. It's as if they genetically engineer these pilchards.
They probably are.
All right, so what happens in Osaka? What's going to be different about this G20?
Well, I think what's going to be interesting about this G20 is that we've got a backdrop of what's going on right now in the Middle East, which really is the single most important thing that's happening in the world right now.
What in particular? Iran and Saudi Arabia?
Yes. Well, the Iran and the U.S.
And the U.S.
Yes. Yeah. And you have to understand the way in which the reason why we got here is because Trump stood for election with the promise that he was going to kill the Iran nuclear deal.
Mm-hmm. And
by the way, I think that was one of the things that Obama actually got right.
Mm-hmm.
But Trump made a promise that he was going to kill that deal. And true to his word, Trump is one of those politicians who is actually going out of his way to keep every single promise. And he did kill that deal. And then he proceeded to impose sanctions upon Iran. And then sends a drone into Iranian airspace. And there's been substantial independent confirmation to show that it did go into Iranian airspace.
Oh, yeah.
And then when the Iranians shoot down the drone, mm-hmm. he then takes it as an act of provocation. And then turns around and says that he was about to launch strikes and then decided not to at the last minute.
Talk about precipitating a crisis.
Yes. Right. So in the meanwhile, while all this is happening, we've got a coming together of RIC. Now,
Russia, India, China.
Russia, India, China. Exactly. Now, BRICS doesn't matter anymore, people. Let's be very clear about
this. Yeah, because the B's fallen off.
The B has fallen off because...
And the S was never really part of it.
Yeah, exactly. So Brazil, ever since Bolsonaro took over, he's very firmly in Trump's camp. And, you know, frankly, the Brazilian economy is in a seriously bad state right mm-hmm. now. So he's got his attention focused on
that. Not dissimilar to our situation in that it was looted outright. And absolutely. The former government was completely cretinous.
There. Yes, but unlike us, they managed to put their former government in jail, which is a good
right.
thing. So now you've suddenly got meeting out at Osaka. We're going to be seeing bilaterals between Russia and India, Russia and China, and China and India.
Mm-hmm.
And trust me, these three are actually planning to shape the next world order as a counterpoint to the United States. That's going to be the single thing that's going to be coming out of
Do they have enough in common? Do they have enough to bring to the table? I mean, Russia in particular.
Well, again, going back to Trump's tweets, start off now with the fact that Trump thinks that the latest tariffs that India has imposed upon the U.S. is completely outrageous and must be removed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
this after he's just done a similar thing with China
and with India. So you know he's been putting up tariffs left, right, and center. And look, I've crunched the numbers on the tariffs, and the tariffs make sense.
Really?
Yes.
You're a free marketeer, and you think tariffs.
I'm saying if you look at it at the numbers in terms of how the U.S. ends up benefiting overall.
Okay.
Yes, the tariffs make sense because you see if you effectively have tariffs of 25%. And the balance of payments is skewed in China's favor, then obviously 25% of the difference is the amount of money that the U.S. profits by.
Right.
It's really that simple if you drill down into the numbers.
Okay.
And he's then able to take a small portion of those tariffs and use it to subsidize his farmers back home. So, mm-hmm. but let's park that and put that aside.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that you've got now China and India and Russia, who are being constantly squeezed by the U.S. in terms of tariffs and all of those things. But they've started off this ecosystem where they are trading amongst each other in their own currencies.
All right.
Which is, again, eliminating the U.S. dollar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, consider this, that if the Straits of Hormuz ends up going pear-shaped,
mm-hmm. that means world oil production, the exporting of oil from the Arabian Peninsula, all of that goes into disarray.
There's a fascinating thing that if you take a look at maps of U.S. bases around the world,
mm-hmm.
directly across the Straits of Hormuz, you've got the UAE, so you've got and you've got Qatar, and every single one of those places have got U.S. military bases or
and
airstrips.
Oman,
yeah, all of those places. Now imagine if there is an attack that is launched against Iran by the U.S. I'll tell you what I would do if I was the Iranian leadership. I would immediately target all of those military bases in all of those countries.
Does Iran even have the capacity to do this?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
They do?
They
absolutely.
Shot down this drone when I looked at the flypaths of what else was around there. You see the precision with which that counter-strike was and how very well thought
yeah,
through.
But
what that means...
I'm sorry, but compared to the U.S.?
But what that means is it means that they are ready and it means that they have the capacity and it means that they are willing. And those three things are the exactly what you need to be there.
I think a war between the US and Iran would be over fairly quickly. I really do.
As
not at all. Absolutely
as America
not.
Is still withdrawing. Still withdrawing out of
what's Iran's
Iraq.
Air force like?
Iran doesn't need the air force capability. Iran just simply needs, and again, you know,
targeted strikes.
Let's be very clear about this. They just need to obliterate
those bases.
Those bases, which and they also need to take out those oil fields, because remember,
well, Iran's big enemy is really Saudi Arabia, which the U.S. are protecting.
Yes, but if Iran takes the view that anyone who is harboring a U.S. military base
is an enemy.
Then suddenly Iran has got every country in the Middle East up against it.
Have you ever taken a look at a map and seen how small those countries are?
Of course they're tiny.
Yes, they're tiny.
Saudi Arabia is not insubstantial.
How many people does Iran have in its army?
No, it's got a huge landed army.
Yes. Have you had a look at the terrain? In terms of Iran,
yeah, mostly mountainous.
Iran is massive. Yeah, Iran is mostly mountainous. Oh,
you've got the Hindu Kush mountains.
Yes,
and
consider that you can't fight the type of ground war that you did in Iraq. Because remember what the U.S. did in Iraq?
That's flat and marshy.
Flat and marshy. And what they did was they just simply used bulldozers. Literally, they went and bulldozed the Iraqi army and just buried them. And you can't do that type of thing in Iran. The terrain is so entirely
But those kinds of wars are over. We do targeted strikes now. We have drones. These things fly far and above the usual clamor of war. We've got different ways of doing things now.
Which
we don't need men in uniforms.
Which is precisely why their response to that drone in their airspace is such a telling sign of how ready they are to take on America.
The most crucial thing that I knew in terms of that drone strike, the Iranian foreign minister tweeted, and he said at 12:15 this drone took off from Qatar. So they tracked it from the point that it took off.
Mm-hmm.
He gave its exact flight path and tracked its coordinates every step of the way, and then at the point at which it strayed into Iranian airspace, that's the point at which they shot it down. So what that's saying is that they actually have eyes on the ground on every single one of those military bases.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they're able to keep track of it.
But then the big picture story here is to go back to Russia, India, and China. They would let Iran fight this proxy war for them to keep the U.S. busy. And on the economic front, they would deal with each other internally. They'd have their own money conversations, and they'd trade within their own little group and try wherever possible to squeeze the U.S. back. So this is all part of a big geopolitical game. It's a game of thrones.
I'm not saying that they deliberately want to do that, but I am saying that the Straits
would be convenient for them.
If the Straits of Hormuz is closed, then that leaves the largest producers of oil in the world being two countries. Which two are those?
Iran.
Well, Iran's not producing at the point at which... So let's assume that Iran's taken out of the picture. The Saudis are effectively out of the picture because the Straits of Hormuz is closed as well.
Russia's
one of them. That leaves Russia and Venezuela as the two biggest. And remember that the Russians have been getting military aircraft on the ground in Venezuela. Trust me, they've been flying in military advisors.
Putin's been president for 25 years.
Indeed.
Sure, talk about a long game.
And he's not scared.
Yeah. So I think.
And I mean, by the way, this just completely makes a mockery of this Mueller report and of all the Trump collusion nonsense, which was clearly cooked up.
Yes. I mean, well, but the Democrats are such absolute idiots because they not actually taking a long-term view in terms of the
It's all about beating Trump.
Yes.
And they imagine that if Bernie Sanders or if Kamala Harris or anyone else was in charge, they'd be in a better position than Trump is now.
Yes.
Which, of course, is nonsense.
But, you know, to his credit, you know, the fact that Trump did not go through with actually doing the bombing, I think that someone actually crunched the numbers and said, listen, guy, if you do this, then the oil supply from Saudi Arabia actually gets shut off.
And
to the rest of the world.
Big trouble.
And then you're in big trouble because the Saudis own most of your government bonds.
And that would mean, obviously, that Trump can be reasonable.
Yes.
so he can be reasoned with.
Exactly.
Money can reason with anyone.
Well, no, I don't think so. Not if you're a billionaire who doesn't care and all you care about is ego and reputation. And you know, for him,
but
it's an opportunity to be the big man, and he's decided not to.
But it's the economics of it.
No, but he doesn't care about that. He'll do whatever he needs to do for him. That's what people have been saying for the last couple of years. That's all we've heard from the Democrats.
Yes.
Our Trump is an egomaniac, and here he is being reasonable. Let's give credit where it's due.
But if we go back to Osaka, what is going to be true is that, you know, we're now going to see Cyril pitching up out there and realizing that he's now very firmly on the sidelines. You know, the most telling thing in terms of BRICS is that the first time that Bolsonaro is going to be meeting with Xi Jinping is going to be at Osaka.
Really? They haven't even made any overtures to each other
There's been no overtures whatsoever. So if you want any proof that BRICS is dead, it's right there. You know, frankly, I think that Zuma was right. He should have had the opportunity to introduce Cyril to his counterparts in BRICS because, you know, maybe Cyril would have had some relevance then in terms of this this global field. Yeah. But, so Osaka this time around, it's going to be important. But it's going to be important because you're going to be seeing a solidifying of the alliance between those three. And look, essentially what's been happening is that Russia and India have both bought into China's idea of this Belt and Road initiative. And India has very firmly got its heart set on actually building that shipping route, but that shipping route has to then go through Iran, through the northern part of Iran, which means that now Russia and India both have vested interests in ensuring that Iran's integrity actually holds together.
Mm.
And the only thing that's standing in the way of this really is the historical border dispute that the Indians and the Chinese have around the Himalayas. But, you know, I'm sure that they can ring fence that border dispute and put it aside for now and say, okay, we'll agree not to talk about this for the next 20 years and let's just proceed with making this other stuff work.
And one thing we do know so far about India, Russia and China is that they all do play the long game.
There are
a lot more strategists involved in what they're doing than in other countries which have knee-jerk reactions. Mm. And we don't have to look very far to see what I mean. Just look at our government.
Yes. Russia's economy, by the way, is going to overtake the UK's economy in size within 2 years.
Is that still an economy based largely on raw materials? I mean, Russia's economy really, after the USSR collapsed, Russia's economy was kind of third world in a lot of respects. It became a minerals, a resources, a raw materials economy. And much of what the Russian financial system was composed of was oligarchic money from people who Boris Yeltsin's daughter and
The way in which the Russians work
had dispatched to various friends and family.
Mm. The way in which the Russians work is that they do their national budget on the assumption that their oil revenue is going to be based on a price tag of around about $30 per barrel.
Mm-hmm.
So with oil levels currently sitting at prices at more than
double that
price.
That helps the Russian economy.
Well, no. What happens is they don't spend that money.
Yes.
Okay. They bank that money, and they bank it literally in terms of gold. Russia has been stockpiling gold. And again, the whole idea is to cut dependence on the U.S. dollar.
Hmm.
So all three of them are actually bailing from the U.S. dollar. And if you have a situation where the yuan actually becomes a reserve currency, which... You know, China has been hinting at for a while,
mm-hmm.
but if you get to that stage, then the U.S. economy is in serious trouble.
You know, you talk about long games, and all of this is what China has been exceptionally good at as we watch world politics and Russia, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that those economies have and those governments have in place is they have a very clear strategy and people who stay on strategy. So they don't have...
And time. They've got time because they're not dealing with internal disputes that a democratic country has to put up with, right? I mean, no one's going to replace Deng unless the whole strategy system.
You mean Xi?
Deng Xiaoping is a long time ago. Sorry.
Yes, uh-huh.
Xi Xiaoping.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And in Russia, Putin has had his hands on the controls for a very long time, right? So they don't have to worry about this irritating democracy thing.
And in India's case, Modi has had, has been handed an overwhelming mandate by, more than a billion people.
Mm. And that for me is one of the things that earlier we were talking about the DA and the EFF is one of the things that lets our politics down, is that there is no long game in place and there is no continuity. So we are in the sixth parliament right now, and every one of those ministers comes in, every one of those MECs comes into the various provinces, and they all have their own kind of legacy project that they are interested in, that they want to put in place. There's no kind of, in the first
if they
5
even
years,
have a, if they even have a legacy project, sometimes it's just so that they can eat.
Yeah, so all of that kind of changing all the time is one of the things that
our politicians,
nothing can get done.
You hit the nail on the head. Our politicians are subsistence politicians. They're actually not producers.
Yes. But they're actually leeches, because they take money from productive spaces and they put it into non-productive ones.
And that's
like the SOEs.
That's the thing.
Or the
Proteas. Is that kind of consistency and that kind of single-minded focus on a long game? Because what we're seeing now is we're seeing the shift of power, of where the real power base is. I mean, America, when they abandoned the gold standard, that's one of the big things that they did, kind of to swing themselves, because they just, so they just have the dollar, and now everybody is dollar based. You've got to have your dollars. And when Russia stockpiles gold and are kind of going back to that kind of, that's what they're doing, is they're simply going, we're going to wean ourselves from a standard that you have created,
but we're going to create
our own standard.
The U.S. is still the largest market for these goods that Russia, China, and India produce. And that does give them leverage. And they're in a strong position in that they can go to other places for these goods, Vietnam and Cambodia and Indonesia and the Philippines and all kinds of other places.
You're absolutely right.
So that is a potential threat from the. If you were China, you'd be looking at that and saying, that's something we've got to be careful not to squeeze too hard.
Well, and China is playing that game very, very carefully, because, the U.S. imposes tariffs, China responds with tariffs in turn, but all the time, the language that's going on between them is, let's talk openly about this stuff.
How do we work together on this?
Yes.
Wow. There was one other thing I wanted to ask you about, this whole India, China, Russia thing and the US, but really stuck in the middle of this is the EU and Britain and this Brexit that's supposed to happen before the end of this year. Boris is likely to be the PM. How does that whole sideshow figure into what's going on at the G20?
We'll have to see what Boris does immediately.
Is that because, are you saying that because you think he's unpredictable?
I think the most crucial thing that Boris needs to do is to actually implement Brexit in time for Halloween.
Is that because the two go together?
Yeah, that's the deadline, 31st of October.
That's their deadline.
But you think that they're both of similar nature? It's dress up.
What do you think?
It's a dress up.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, look, I think Brexit actually, the way in which he manages the entire Brexit process is not only going to determine...
What's optimal here? A no-deal Brexit?
Look, I think that, everyone keeps talking about the no-deal Brexit, but I mean, the fact is that you can already start putting in place regulations that are going to deal with, for example, air traffic.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that stuff? The biggest stumbling block that Boris has got to deal with right now is the Northern Ireland versus Ireland border dispute, because frankly that is the big issue for them, because clearly Ireland and Northern Ireland don't want a situation where there's a hard border in place, but the EU rules insist that there should be a hard border. Well, actually that's not quite true, because you don't have a hard border between let's say Serbia and the European Union. You don't have a hard border between Switzerland and the European Union.
I mean, I drove through Switzerland into France, and there wasn't so much as a "Hi, what's going on?"
Exactly. So this is all posturing on part of the Europeans, particularly on the part of the Germans. But, you know, ultimately, everyone is terrified that, you know, what happens if other countries actually start following suit?
This is a more direct question then. What possible good can come from Germany making it harder for Britain to just get on with it and get out? Why would Germany, what's their motivation to keep things complicated?
Difficult to say.
That's a really obvious question that I haven't found a decent answer for yet. Maybe I should ask the Germans. Let's get them in here. This is the Germans. Why was Angela Merkel shaking like that the other day during the playing of the national anthem? Did you see that video?
I missed that.
Yes, I did.
Tell me, shaking like a shitting dog while the German national anthem was playing. See how you saw it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it looked very bizarre.
She said while they were singing the national anthem and they were standing outside, she was literally shaking. Then as she walked inside, there was a bit of a press conference. And in her words, she says, no, this is no need for anyone to worry. She was actually dehydrated.
It's maybe because of the heat wave that they're experiencing.
She said she was dehydrated and had a couple of glasses of water, and then she was fine. But that is not normal shaking.
She didn't look well. No, but they are having a mega heat wave.
It looked like a minor fit. I'm not even being dramatic.
Yeah, almost like a little
like
bit of a
Wendy
mini,
Williams.
Like a mini stroke or something. I mean, she's really, it didn't look very good. And then she had this to say in German.
Ihnen persönlich, man hat gesehen, als Sie draußen gewartet haben auf die militärischen Ehren, haben Sie angefangen zu
sagen, you know, how do you feel? Do you need to be concerned about your state?
Also ich habe inzwischen mindestens 3 Gläser Wasser getrunken. Das hat.
I had 3 glasses of water. I obviously needed that.
Geht es mir,
and now I'm feeling much better. That's what she said.
She's a lady of a particular age. She's 64.
Wow, okay. Looks good for 64. Do you think she's going to be in there for long? Because the German system is also very complicated. It's not as if Angela can plan too much in advance.
She's already announced that she stepped down.
Yeah, but what does this mean for Germany?
Yes. Yeah. The interesting thing about Germany is that they've actually got too much money.
What a problem to have.
Yeah, but what that means is that they do really stupid stuff. Now, you might remember a few years ago, Angela Merkel took this very high-profile decision to shut down all nuclear power plants in Germany.
Yes.
And said, we're going to be going
clean
energy, we're going to be going solar, we're going to be going renewables.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what's happened since?
No.
The solar and renewables were not able to deliver on the type of capacity that they needed. So what did they replace it with?
Nuclear.
Coal.
Coal.
Oh, God, no.
Yes.
Take 2 steps back.
Exactly. You know, hence my saying that the Germans have got too much money.
Yeah.
Because it allows them to do stupid decisions.
The luxury of stupidity.
Yes.
Okay, well, there's an interesting point to end it on because we've got to wrap it up. Been a fascinating, this has really been one of my favorite Burning Platforms. We went international, we looked at the big picture. Now I'm suddenly excited about the G20. I never thought I'd say those words. All right, Pumi, thank you very much. Canton, thank you very much. The Burning Platform is brought to you by Nando's. And if you'd like to hear any of the stuff you might have missed, you can go and download the podcast. It'll be ready shortly.
This is CliffCentral.com.